This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with my colleague Gregory Copley of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Colombia, in the news in these last hours, because the president of Colombia, a man who in his youth was a member of a terrorist gang of mass murder, is now said to have refused the flight from the United States carrying illegal, undocumented workers who were associated with crime. They came back the way they always had, chained together, because on the aircraft where they're being transported, they don't want to risk fights or overwhelming conduct by criminals. So they're transported accordingly. When they reach their destination, they're unshackled and turned back to the country of their origin. Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, who's very unpopular these days, turned back the plane initially, saying it was disrespectful. That was reversed later after President Trump had made remarks about a tariff imposed on Colombia, and one-third of Colombia's trade is with the U.S., long associated with good relations with Washington. This is not an isolated incident. We've had similar remarks from Lula da Silva in Brasilia. Respect. There'll be other remarks, too. However, it would appear that the pink tide of recent elections in South America is troubled by the fact that President Trump is sending back their criminals to be followed by more people who have emigrated to the United States and are not welcome to stay. Gregory, are we seeing what you'd have to say is a weakness of the pink tide, that they don't know what to do when you call their bluff about migration?
Well, yes. The reality is that the globalist tendency, left tendency, which we've seen being supported by Beijing for the last couple of decades, is now being confronted by a much stronger nationalist movement. We saw this starting in 2016, and it's been waning and ebbing and flowing ever since that time. So right now, particularly with the Trump victory, we see the nationalist movements in the ascendancy, not only in the United States, but also in Europe, and the tendencies for them to grow elsewhere, including as we saw in Argentina a year ago. So the reality is that we have discussed on this program several times the decline of prestige by the United States and how that was making its foreign policy and its power projection much more expensive, because when prestige won't coerce people into doing what you want, you have to use force. The reality is that the prestige of literally every government in the world is now in decline. And President Trump's return to try to rebuild U.S. stature and prestige is starting to work. Now, he wisely starts with some of the smaller countries, which confront him as though they were talking to President Biden, saying, well, we don't accept that, and, you know, this or that, and, you know, we're going to disavow the dollar and this and that. Well, when President Gustavo Petro did that from Colombia, and President Trump immediately responded with saying, well, that's your goose cook then, you've got this tariff, President Petro had to back down in a humiliating fashion. And this is going to color how other countries react as well. So as the U.S. and President Trump start to exert their authority and coercive capability without having to use military force, we will start to see the U.S. negotiating position around the world improve significantly. It's already, as you say, worked with Colombia. It's going to have an influence in Panama, where President Trump has said that he wants to recover the Panama Canal from Chinese control. Now, the question is how he goes about it. His big thing was saying we're going to take it back. Well, what he doesn't want to do is use military force to achieve that. But now his negotiating position is getting better and better. And that's going to be significant, not just for Colombia and Panama and other countries, but it will start to, if you like, encourage this conservative resistance from the bankruptcy of the leftist governments which have been dominating Brazil, or Venezuela and Chile and the like. So it's going to be an interesting transformation. And I think this is part of, in the Americas, of the new Monroe Doctrine, which a lot of Trump people have been talking about, a new focus by Washington on South America and Latin America and Central America and the Caribbean and the like. It's a long process, but the situation with regard to Panama and Colombia are really significant steps, considering it's only been a week into the Trump presidency.
The new Secretary of State, Mr. Rubio, is headed to Central America first, to Panama, El Salvador, Guatemala. The Dominican Republic will also be visited, Costa Rica. Is it significant that he's not visiting Mexico or Brazil on his first venture?
Well, I think you don't want to try to bite off too much, and you want to make sure that you have a lot of attention with what you do in each of these visits. So I think keeping Brazil and Mexico as separate targets for more considered, deep, symbolic discussions is going to be important. Mexico of prime importance because it's the neighbor state and because it's very, very different from Brazil. And there's a chance to really talk to the Mexican government in a way which will yield positive results, as has been done in the past when you've had very hostile Mexican governments come into accord with the United States, and maybe the United States in accord with them, on border issues, on trade issues and the like, bearing in mind that Mexico is a really significant trading partner for the U.S.
Greenland. I've been waiting for this to get to it, Gregory. Greenland, the largest non-continental island on the planet, in the solar system, to our knowledge. Greenland is Danish territory, along with the Faroe Islands, has been, well, sentimentally for several hundred years, 800 years perhaps, Viking times. But certainly since the end of the Second War, when Denmark was freed of the Nazi occupation and the U.S. handed back control of Greenland to Denmark. Mr. Trump made a phone call to the Prime Minister, Frederiksen, of Greenland, of Denmark, and said he wanted to buy it. And he was told it's not for sale. He then made remarks about tariffs, and we're told that Greenland has been in an upset ever since. Now, the president of France most recently is quoted as saying he supports the sovereignty of his fellow European Union members and supports the refusal of Greenland to give in to the pressure from the U.S. The pressure from the U.S., as I understand it, is not about the ice melting and finding gold mines underneath. It's about the Arctic Ocean opening up and positioning U.S. forces correctly to cover the Atlantic side of the U.S., the Greenland, UK, the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap famous during the Cold War. The Russians are already conducting and have for several years conducting military exercises at their Arctic base. They've also claimed the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. The Chinese are building large icebreakers. The Russians already have them. We have very little. And the nature of icebreakers, I think right now there are two. Maybe there's just one. So Mr. Trump says he wants it for the defense of North America. Is it a practical claim? And will this be something that he can bring pressure on Denmark to hand over Greenland for some reward?
Well, the U.S. and Canada are very poorly equipped lately in controlling the seas around the Arctic Circle, much less so than, for example, Russia. Russia's already got five nuclear-powered icebreakers patrolling its Arctic waters, in addition to conventional icebreakers. The U.S. has got one or two. Canada's, I think, got one major one. The new U.S. polar security cutter, of which six have been ordered, was due to be in service for the U.S. Coast Guard by 2027. That's not going to happen. It's going to be a year or 2 years after that at best. So is the answer then for the US to find a way to deploy to Greenland? And is occupying or owning Greenland going to be the best solution to that? President Trump's, if you like, wolf warrior diplomacy, where he throws out a bold statement or demand up front, is used to open negotiations. And certainly he got the Danes' attention. The Danes, however, are absolutely historically and legally connected to their incorporation of the Faroe Islands and Greenland as part of Denmark. And they don't want to part with it, understandably. Can the US negotiate new and improved basing agreements in Greenland, as they did during World War II, when they controlled it while the Danish mainland was occupied by Nazi Germany? Absolutely. The question is, would ownership of Greenland be beneficial, or would it be seen as real expansionism, imperialism, if you like, by the US in taking over more and more territories? And would that help its cause or not? And we have to bear in mind that Denmark is a fellow NATO member and always been a loyal one at that. Yes, it's not the biggest NATO member, but it is a loyal ally of the United States. And now its people feel offended by the way in which the US has postured this situation. There's no question that the Arctic is now, and more importantly, the Antarctic, are both incredibly important to strategic power projection today and in the future. And the situation in Antarctica is even worse than the situation in the Arctic as far as the US and its allies are concerned. So, yes, get Greenland under control, preferably by basing agreements, and start to rethink the Antarctic Treaty as well. This is absolutely critical.
Just a detail about Greenland. There is a subsidy paid by Denmark and for the Faroe Islands as well. This has to do with defense, not with making money, not with property values and that sort of thing. It could come to that, I understand. But is Denmark or even its NATO allies, are they in a good position to help us defend North America? That seems, when you look at the map, you go, what are they going to do about it? They don't have a fleet and they're not basing military assets in Greenland. I'm talking about Denmark.
Yes, well, Denmark does have an army, navy and air force, and it's part of the NATO infrastructure. And part of NATO's mission is to respect the sovereignty of its fellow members. And the question is, does the United States respect the sovereignty of its allies or not? If the United States were to try to take over Greenland or Canada or Australia, well, what about Japan? I mean, the reality is that there are more ways to skin a cat than by taking it over and saying you're not doing your part. It's their country. And if you want to go to war and take it from them, good luck to you. It doesn't make you any more popular and may cause you more problems in the long run. If you want to negotiate a basing agreement, that's another matter altogether. But bear in mind that the US's allies have often fought wars which have saved the United States before the US has committed to action. World War I, World War II, and look at the cost in human lives and economics to the allies of the United States when the United States was just staying out of the war and making a lot of money by selling war material to the allies before it was finally dragged in because Japan made the mistake of attacking Pearl Harbor. The reality is that the United States now needs its allies more than ever before, largely because of the declining strength of the United States in the balance with the People's Republic of China and so on. And so why alienate Denmark or why alienate Canada or Australia or any others? I noticed that President Trump has never raised a question which might offend the Japanese, for example, because I think he knows that this would be perhaps an irreversible mistake.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.